Side 2, Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth, by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing with, of Tuor and his coming to Gondolin, on page 27. And as he stepped down from the doors, the swans did him reverence, and plucking each a great feather from their wings, they proffered them to him, laying their long necks upon the stone before his feet. And he took the 7 feathers, and set them in the crest of his helm, and straightway the swans arose and flew north in the sunset, and Tuor saw them no more. Now Tuor felt his feet drawn to the sea strand, and he went down by long stairs to a wide shore upon the north side of Tarasness. And as he went, he saw that the sun was sinking low into a great black cloud that came up over the rim of the darkening sea, and it grew cold, and there was a stirring and murmur as of a storm to come. And Tuor stood upon the shore, and the sun was like a smoky fire behind the menace of the sky. And it seemed to him that a great wave rose far off and rolled towards the land. But wonder held him, and he remained there, unmoved. And the wave came towards him, and upon it lay a mist of shadow. Then suddenly, as it drew near, it curled and broke, and rushed forward in long arms of foam. But where it had broken, there stood dark, against the rising storm, a living shape of great height and majesty. Then Tuor bowed in reverence, for it seemed to him that he beheld a mighty king. A tall crown he wore like silver, from which his long hair fell down as foam, glimmering in the dusk. And as he cast back the gray mantle that hung about him like a mist, behold, he was clad in a gleaming coat, close fitted as the mail of a mighty fish, and in a kirtle of deep green that flashed and flickered with sea-fire as he strode slowly towards the land. In this manner the dweller of the deep, whom the Noldor name Ulmo, Lord of Waters, showed himself to Tuor, son of Huor, of the house of Hador, beneath Vinyamar. He set no foot upon the shore, but standing knee-deep in the shadowy sea, he spoke to Tuor. And then for the light of his eyes and for the sound of his deep voice that came, as it seemed, from the foundations of the world, fear fell upon Tuor, and he cast himself down upon the sand.
"Arise, Tuor, son of Huor," said Ulmo. "Fear not my wrath, though long have I called to thee, unheard. And setting out at last, thou hast tarried on thy journey hither. In the spring thou shouldst have stood here. But now a fell winter cometh soon from the land of the enemy. Haste thou must learn, and the pleasant road that I designed for thee must be changed. For my counsels have been scorned, and a great evil creeps upon the valley of Sirion. And already a host of foes is come between thee and thy goal."
Note 8. This must refer to the warning of Ulmo brought to Nargothrond by Gelmir and Arminas. See pages 159 and the following. End of note.
"What then is my goal, lord?" said Tuor.
"That which thy heart hath ever sought," answered Ulmo, "to find Turgon and look upon the hidden city. For thou art arrayed thus to be my messenger, even in the arms which long ago I decreed for thee. Yet now thou must under shadow pass through peril. Wrap thyself, therefore, in this cloak, and cast it never aside until thou come to thy journey's end."
Then it seemed to Tuor that Ulmo parted his gray mantle and cast to him a lappet. And as it fell about him, it was for him a great cloak, wherein he might wrap himself over all from head to foot.
"Thus thou shalt walk under my shadow," said Ulmo. "But tarry no more, for in the lands of Anar and in the fires of Melkor it will not endure. Wilt thou take up my errand?"
"I will, lord," said Tuor.
"Then I will set words in thy mouth to say unto Turgon," said Ulmo. "But first I will teach thee. And some things thou shalt hear which no man else hath heard, nay, not even the mighty among the Eldar."
And Ulmo spoke to Tuor of Valinor and its darkening, and the exile of the Noldor, and the doom of Mondos, and the hiding of the Blessed Realm.
"But behold," said he, "in the armor of fate, as the children of earth name it, there is ever a rift, and in the walls of doom a breach, until the full making, which ye call the end.
So it shall be while I endure a secret voice that gainsayeth, and a light where darkness was decreed. Therefore, though in the days of this darkness I seem to oppose the will of my brethren, the lords of the West, that is my part among them, to which I was appointed ere the making of the world. Yet doom is strong, and the shadow of the enemy lengthens, and I am diminished, until in Middle Earth I am become now no more than a secret whisper. The waters that run westward wither, and their springs are poisoned, and my power withdraws from the land. For elves and men grow blind and deaf to me because of the might of Melkor. And now the curse of Mondos hastens to its fulfillment, and all the works of the Noldor shall perish, and every hope which they build shall crumble. The last hope alone is left, the hope that they have not looked for and have not prepared. And that hope lieth in thee, for so I have chosen.
Then shall Turgon not stand against Morgoth, as all the Eldar yet hope? Said Tuar. And what wouldst thou of me, lord, if I come now to Turgon? For though I am indeed willing to do as my father and stand by that king in his need, yet of little avail shall I be, a mortal man alone, among so many and so valiant of the high folk of the West.
If I choose to send thee, Tuar, son of Huar, then believe not that thy one sword is not worth the sending. For the valor of the Edo and the elves shall ever remember as the ages lengthen, marveling that they gave life so freely, of which they had on earth so little. But it is not for thy valor only that I send thee, but to bring into the world a hope beyond thy sight, and a light that shall pierce the darkness.
And as Ulmo said these things, the mutter of the storm rose to a great cry, and the wind mounted, and the sky grew black, and the mantle of the Lord of Waters streamed out like a flying cloud.
Go now, said Ulmo, lest the sea devour thee. For Ase obeys the will of Mondos, and he is wroth, being a servant of the doom.
As thou commandest, said Tuar, but if I escape the doom, what words shall I say unto Turgon?
If thou come to him, answered Ulmo, then the words shall arise in thy mind, and thy mouth shall speak as I would. Speak, and fear not, and therefore do as thy heart and valor lead thee. Hold fast to my mantle, for thus shalt thou be guarded. And I will send one to thee out of the wrath of Ase, and thus shalt thou be guided. Yea, the last mariner of the last ship that shall seek into the west until the rising of the star. Go now, back to the land.
Then there was a noise of thunder, and lightning flared over the sea, and Tuor beheld Ulmo standing among the waves as a tower of silver flickering with darting flames. And he cried against the wind,
I go, Lord! Yet now my heart yearneth rather to the sea.
And thereupon Ulmo lifted up a mighty horn, and blew upon it a single great note, to which the roaring of the storm was but a wind-flaw upon a lake. And as he heard that note, and was encompassed by it, and filled with it, it seemed to Tuar that the coasts of Middle-earth vanished, and he surveyed all the waters of the world in a great vision, from the veins of the lands to the mouths of the rivers, and from the strands and estuaries out into the deep. The great sea he saw, through its unquiet regions, teeming with strange forms, even to its lightless depths, in which amid the everlasting darkness there echoed voices terrible to mortal ears. Its measureless plains he surveyed with a swift sight of the Valar, lying windless under the eye of Anar, or glittering under the horned moon, or lifted in hills of wrath that broke upon the shadowy isles, until remote upon the edge of sight, and beyond the count of leagues, he glimpsed a mountain, rising beyond his mind's reach, into a shining cloud, and at its feet a long surf glimmering. Note 9. The shadowy isles are very probably the enchanted isles described at the end of the Silmarillion, Chapter 11, which were strung as a net in the shadowy seas from the north to the south at the time of the hiding of Valinor. End of note. And even as he strained to hear the sound of those far waves and to see clearer that distant light, the note ended, and he stood beneath the thunder of the storm, and lightning many-branched rent asunder the heavens above him. And Ulmo was gone, and the sea was in tumult, as the wild waves of Ase rode against the walls of Nevrost.
Then Tuor fled from the fury of the sea, and with labor he won his way back to the high terraces. For the wind drove him against the cliff, and when he came out upon the top, it bent him to his knees. Therefore he entered again the dark and empty hall for shelter, and he sat night long in the stone seat of Turgon. The very pillars trembled for the violence of the storm, and it seemed to Tuor that the wind was full of wailing and wild cries. Yet being weary, he slept at times, and his sleep was troubled with many dreams, of which naught remained in waking memory, save one, a vision of an isle, and in the midst of it was a steep mountain, and behind it the sun went down, and shadows sprang into the sky, but above it there shone a single dazzling star. After this dream, Tuor fell into a deep sleep, for before the night was over the tempest passed, driving the black clouds into the east of the world. He awoke at length in the gray light, and arose, and left the high seat. And as he went down the dim hall, he saw that it was filled with sea-birds, driven in by the storm, and he went out as the last stars were fading in the west before the coming day. Then he saw that the great waves in the night had ridden high upon the land, and had cast their crests above the cliff-tops, and weed and shingle-drift were flung even upon the terraces before the doors. And Tuor looked down from the lowest terrace, and saw, leaning against its wall among the stones and the sea-wrack, an elf, clad in a gray cloak, sodden with the sea. Silent, he sat, gazing beyond the ruin of the beaches, out over the long ridges of the waves. All was still, and there was no sound save the roaring of the surf below. As Tuor stood and looked at the silent gray figure, he remembered the words of Umo, and a name untaught came to his lips, and he called aloud,
"Welcome, Varanwë! I await you."
Note 10. Compare the Silmarillion, page 196. At the bidding of Turgon, after the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad, Círdan built 7 swift ships, and they sailed out into the west. But no tidings of them came ever back to Balar, save of one and the last. The mariners of that ship toiled long in the sea, and returning at last in despair, they foundered in a great storm, within sight of the coasts of Middle-earth. But one of them was saved by Umo from the wrath of Ossë, and the waves bore him up and cast him ashore in Nevrost. His name was Varanwë, and he was one of those that Turgon sent forth as messengers from Gondolin. Compare also the Silmarillion, page 239. End of note. Then the elf turned and looked up, and Tuor met the piercing glance of his sea-gray eyes, and knew that he was of the high folk of the Noldor. But fear and wonder grew in his gaze as he saw Tuor standing high upon the wall above him, clad in his great cloak like a shadow out of which the elven mail gleamed upon his breast. A moment thus they stayed, each searching the face of the other, and then the elf stood up and bowed low before Tuor's feet.
"Who are you, lord?" he said. "Long have I labored in the unrelenting sea. Tell me, have great tidings befallen since I walked the land? Is the shadow overthrown? Have the hidden people come forth?"
"Nay," Tuor answered. "The shadow lengthens, and the hidden remain hid." Then Varanwë looked at him long in silence.
"But who are you?" he asked again.
"For many years ago my people left this land, and none have dwelt here since. And now I perceive that despite your raiment, you are not of them, as I thought, but are of the kindred of men." "I am," said Tuor. "And are you not the last mariner of the last ship that sought the west from the havens of Círdan?"
"I am," said the elf.
"Varanwë, son of Varanwë, am I. But how you know my name and fate, I understand not." "I know, for the Lord of Waters spoke to me yestereve," answered Tuor, "and he said that he would save you from the wrath of Ossë, and send you hither to be my guide." Then, in fear and wonder, Varanwë cried,
"You have spoken with Ulmo the Mighty? Then great indeed must be your worth and doom. But whither should I guide you, lord? For surely a king of men you must be, and many must wait upon your word."
"Nay, I am an escaped thrall," said Tuor,
and I am an outlaw, alone in an empty land. But I have an errand to Turgon, the Hidden King. Know you by what road I may find him?
Many are outlaw and thrall in these evil days, who were not born so, answered Varanwë.
A lord of men by right you are, I deem. But were you the highest of all your folk, no right would you have to seek Turgon, and vain would be your quest. For even were I to lead you to his gates, you could not enter in.
I do not bid you to lead me further than the gate, said Tuar.
There Doom shall strive with the council of Ulmo, and if Turgon will not receive me, then my errand will be ended, and Doom shall prevail. But as for my right to seek Turgon, I am Tuar, son of Huar, and kin to Hurin, whose names Turgon will not forget. And I seek also by the command of Ulmo. Will Turgon forget that which he spoke to him of old? Remember that the last hope of the Noldor cometh from the sea? Or again, when peril is nigh, one shall come from Nevrost to warn thee.
Note 11. The words of Ulmo to Turgon appear in the Silmarillion, chapter 15, in the form, Remember that the true hope of the Noldor lieth in the west, and cometh from the sea. But if this peril draweth nigh indeed, then even from Nevrost one shall come to warn thee. End of note.
I am he that should come, and I am arrayed thus in the gear that was prepared for me.
Tuar marveled to hear himself speak so, for the words of Ulmo to Turgon at his going from Nevrost were not known to him before, nor to any save the hidden people. Therefore the more amazed was Varanwë, but he turned away and looked toward the sea, and he sighed.
Alas, he said, I wish never again to return, and often have I vowed in the deeps of the sea that if ever I set foot on land again, I would dwell at rest far from the shadow in the north, or by the havens of Círdan, or maybe in the fair fields of Nantathrin, where the spring is sweeter than heart's desire. But if evil has grown while I have wandered, and the last peril approaches them, then I must go to my people.
He turned back to Tuar.
I will lead you to the hidden gates, he said, for the wise will not gainsay the counsels of Ulmo.
Then we will go together, as we are counseled, said Tuar.
But mourn not, Varanwë, for my heart says to you that far from the shadow your long road shall lead you, and your hope shall return to the sea.
Note 12. Nothing is told in the Silmarillion of the further fate of Varanwë after his return to Gondolin with Tuar. But in the original story of Tuar and the exiles of Gondolin, he was one of those who escaped from the sack of the city, as is implied by the words of Tuar here. End of note.
And yours also, said Varanwë. But now we must leave it, and go in haste.
Yea, said Tuar, but whither will you lead me, and how far? Shall we not first take thought how we may fare in the wild, or if the way be long, how pass the harborless winter?
But Varanwë would answer nothing clearly concerning the road.
You know the strength of men, he said.
As for me, I am of the Noldor, and long must be the hunger, and cold the winter that shall slay the kin of those who passed the grinding ice. Yet how think you that we could labor countless days in the salt wastes of the sea? Or have you not heard of the waybread of the elves? And I keep still that which all mariners hold until the last.
Then he showed beneath his cloak a sealed wallet clasped upon his belt.
No water nor weather will harm it while it is sealed, but we must husband it until great need. And doubtless an outlaw and hunter may find other food ere the year worsens.
Maybe, said Tuar. But not in all lands is it safe to hunt, be the game never so plentiful, and hunters tarry on the road.
Now Tuar and Varanwë made ready to depart. Tuar took with him the small bow and arrows that he had brought, beside the gear that he had taken from the hall. But his spear, upon which his name was written in the elven runes of the north, he set upon the wall in token that he had passed. No arms had Varanwë, save a short sword only. Before the day was broad, they left the ancient dwelling of Turgon, and Varanwë led Tuar about, westward of the steep slopes of Taras, and across the Great Cape. There once the road from Nevrost to Brithombar had passed, that now was but a green track between old, turf-clad dikes. So they came into Beleriand and the north region of the Falas, and turning eastward, they sought the dark eaves of arid Wethrin, and there they lay hid and rested until day had waned to dusk. For though the ancient dwellings of the Falathrim, Brithombar and Eglarest, were still far distant, orcs now dwelt there, and all the land was infested by the spies of Morgoth. He feared the ships of Círdan that would come at times raiding to the shores and join with the forays sent forth from Nargothrond. Now, as they sat shrouded in their cloaks as shadows under the hills, Tuor and Varanwë spoke much together, and Tuor questioned Varanwë concerning Turgon, but Varanwë would tell little of such matters, and spoke rather of the dwellings upon the Isle of Balar and of the Lisgarth, the land of reeds at the mouths of Sirion. "There now the numbers of the Eldar increase," he said, "for evermore flee thither of either kin from the fear of Morgoth, weary of war. But I forsook not my people of my own choice. For after the Bragolach and the breaking of the siege of Angband, doubt first came into Turgon's heart that Morgoth might prove too strong. In that year he sent out the first of his folk that passed his gates from within, a few only, upon a secret errand. They went down Sirion to the shores about the mouths, and there built ships. But it availed them nothing, save to come to the great Isle of Balar, and there establish lonely dwellings, far from the reach of Morgoth. For the Noldor have not the art of building ships that will long endure the waves of Beleaguer the Great. Note 13. Compare the Silmarillion, page 159. Turgon believed, also, that the ending of the siege was the beginning of the downfall of the Noldor, unless aid should come. And he sent companies of the Gondolindrim in secret to the mouths of Sirion and the Isle of Balar. There they built ships and set sail into the uttermost west upon Turgon's errand, seeking for Valinor, to ask for pardon and aid of the Valar. And they besought the birds of the sea to guide them. But the seas were wild and wide, and shadow and enchantment lay upon them, and Valinor was hidden. Therefore none of the messengers of Turgon came into the west, and many were lost, and few returned. In one of the constituent texts of the Silmarillion, it is said that although the Noldor had not the art of shipbuilding, and all the craft that they built foundered or were driven back by the winds, yet after the Dagor Bragolach, Turgon ever maintained a secret refuge upon the Isle of Balar. And when, after the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad, Círdan and the remnant of his people fled from Brithombar and Eglarest to Balar, they mingled with Turgon's outpost there. But this element in the story was rejected, and thus in the published text of the Silmarillion there is no reference to the establishment of dwellings on Balar by elves from Gondolin. End of note. But when later Turgon heard of the ravaging of the Falas and the sack of the ancient havens of the shipwrights that lie away there before us, and it was told that Círdan had saved a remnant of his people and sailed away south to the Bay of Balar, then he sent out messengers anew. That was but a little while ago, yet it seems in memory the longest portion of my life, for I was one of those that he sent, being young in years among the Eldar. I was born here in Middle-earth, in the land of Nevrost. My mother was of the grey elves of the Falas, and akin to Círdan himself. There was much mingling of the peoples in Nevrost in the first days of Turgon's kingship, and I have the sea-heart of my mother's people. Therefore I was among the chosen, since our errand was to Círdan, to seek his aid in our shipbuilding, that some message and prayer for aid might come to the lords of the West ere all was lost. But I tarried on the way, for I had seen little of the lands of Middle-earth, and we came to Nontothrim in the spring of the year. Lovely to heart's enchantment is that land, Tuor, as you shall find, if ever your feet go upon the southward roads down Sirion. There is the cure of all sea-longing, save for those whom doom will not release. There Ulmo is but the servant of Yavanna, and the earth has brought to life a wealth of fair things that is beyond the thought of hearts in the hard hills of the north. In that land, Narag joins Sirion, and they haste no more, but flow broad and quiet through living meads. And all about the shining river are flag lilies, like a blossoming forest, and the grass is filled with flowers, like gems, like bells, like flames of red and gold, like a waste of many-colored stars in a firmament of green. Yet fairest of all are the willows of Nontothryn, pale green or silver in the wind, and the rustle of their innumerable leaves is a spell of music. Day and night would flicker by uncounted, while still I stood knee-deep in grass and listened. There I was enchanted and forgot the sea in my heart. There I wandered, naming new flowers, or lay a dream amid the singing of the birds and the humming of bees and flies. And there I might still dwell in delight, forsaking all my kin, whether the ships of the Teleri or the swords of the Noldor. But my doom would not so, or the Lord of Waters himself, maybe, for he was strong in that land. Thus it came into my heart to make a raft of willow boughs and move upon the bright bosom of Sirion. And so I did, and so I was taken. For on a day, as I was in the midst of the river, a sudden wind came and caught me, and bore me away out of the land of willows, down to the sea. Thus I came last of the messengers to Círdan, and of the 7 ships that he built at Turgon's, asking all but one were then full wrought. And one by one they set sail into the west, and none yet has ever returned, nor has any news of them been heard. But the salt air of the sea now stirred anew the heart of my mother's kin within me, and I rejoiced in the waves, learning all ship-lore, as were it already stored in the mind. So when the last ship and the greatest was made ready, I was eager to be gone, saying within my thought, "If the words of the Noldor be true, then in the west there are meads with which the land of willows cannot compare. There is no withering, nor any end of spring. And perhaps even I, Varanwë, may come thither. And at the worst, to wander on the waters is better far than the shadow in the north." And I feared not, for the ships of the Teleri no water may drown. But the great sea is terrible, Tuor, son of Huar, and it hates the Noldor, for it works the doom of the Valar. Worse things it holds than to sink into the abyss and so perish. Loathing and loneliness and madness, terror of wind and tumult, and silence, and shadows where all hope is lost, and all living shapes pass away, and many shores evil and strange it washes, and many islands of danger and fear infest it. I will not darken your heart, son of Middle-earth, with the tale of my labor 7 years in the great sea from the north, even into the south, but never to the west, for that is shut against us. At the last, in black despair, weary of all the world, we turned and fled from the doom that so long had spared us, only to strike us the more cruelly. For even as we descried a mountain from afar, and I cried, "Lo, there is Taras, and the land of my birth," the wind awoke, and great clouds thunder-laden came up from the west. Then the waves hunted us like living things filled with malice, and the lightnings smote us. And when we were broken down to a helpless hull, the seas leaped upon us in fury. But as you see, I was spared, for it seemed to me that there came a wave, greater and yet calmer than all the others, and it took me and lifted me from the ship, and bore me high upon its shoulders, and rolling to the land, it cast me upon the turf, and then drained away, pouring back over the cliff in a great waterfall. There but 1 hour had I sat, when you came upon me, still dazed by the sea, and still I feel the fear of it, and the bitter loss of all my friends that went with me so long and so far beyond the sight of mortal lands. Varanwë sighed, and spoke then softly, as if to himself. But very bright were the stars upon the margin of the world, when at times the clouds about the west were drawn aside. Yet whether we saw only clouds still more remote, or glimpsed indeed, as some held, the mountains of the Pelori, about the lost strands of our long home, I know not. Far, far away they stand, and none from mortal lands shall come there ever again, I deem. Then Varanwë fell silent, for night had come, and the stars shone white and cold. Soon after, Tuor and Varanwë arose, and turned their backs toward the sea, and set out upon their long journey in the dark, of which there is little to tell, for the shadow of Ulmo was upon Tuor, and none saw them pass, by wood or stone, by field or fen, between the setting and the rising of the sun. But ever warily they went, shunning the night-eyed hunters of Morgoth and forsaking the trodden ways of elves and men. Varanwë chose their path, and Tuor followed. He asked no vain questions, but noted well that they went ever eastward along the march of the rising mountains and turned never southward, at which he wondered, for he believed, as did well nigh all elves and men, that Turgon dwelt far from the battles of the north. Slow was their going by twilight or by night in the pathless wilds, and the fell winter came down swiftly from the realm of Morgoth. Despite the shelter of the hills, the winds were strong and bitter, and soon the snow lay deep upon the heights, or whirled through the passes and fell upon the woods of Nuath, ere the full shedding of their withered leaves. Note 14. The woods of Nuath are not mentioned in the Silmarillion, and are not marked on the map that accompanies it. They extended westward from the upper waters of the Narog towards the source of the River Nenning. End of note. Thus, though they set out before the middle of Narquellia, the Hissame came in with biting frost, even as they drew nigh to the sources of Narog. There, at the end of a weary night, in the gray of dawn, they halted, and Varanwë was dismayed, looking about him in grief and fear. Where once the fair pool of Ivrin had lain in its great stone basin carved by falling waters, and all about it had been a tree-clad hollow under the hills, now he saw a land defiled and desolate. The trees were burned or uprooted, and the stone marges of the pool were broken, so that the waters of Ivrin strayed and wrought a great barren marsh amid the ruin. All now was but a welter of frozen mire, and a reek of decay lay like a foul mist upon the ground.
"Alas, has the evil come even here?" Varanwë cried. "Once far from the threat of Angband was this place, but ever the fingers of Morgoth grope further." "It is even as Ulmo spoke to me," said Tuor. "The springs are poisoned, and my power withdraws from the waters of the land."
"Yet," said Varanwë, "a malice has been here, with strength greater than that of orcs. Fear lingers in this place." And he searched about the edges of the mire, until suddenly he stood still and cried again,
"Yea, a great evil!"
And he beckoned to Tuor, and Tuor coming saw a slot like a huge furrow that passed away southward, and at either side, now blurred, now sealed hard and clear by frost, the marks of great clawed feet.
"See," said Varanwë,
and his face was pale with dread and loathing. "Here, not long since, was the great worm of Angband, most fell of all the creatures of the enemy. Late already is our errand to Turgon. There is need of haste." Even as he spoke thus, they heard a cry in the woods, and they stood still as gray stones, listening. But the voice was a fair voice, though filled with grief, and it seemed that it called ever upon a name, as one that searches for another who is lost. And as they waited, one came through the trees, and they saw that he was a tall man, armed, clad in black, with a long sword drawn. And they wondered, for the blade of the sword also was black, but the edges shone bright and cold. Woe was graven in his face, and when he beheld the ruin of Ivrin, he cried aloud in grief, saying,
"Ivrin, Vailivrin, Gwyndor and Beleg, here once I was healed, but now never shall I drink the draught of peace again."
Then he went swiftly away towards the north, as one in pursuit, or on an errand of great haste, and they heard him cry,
"Vailivrin! Finduilas!"
until his voice died away in the woods. Note 15. Compare the Silmarillion, pages 209 and 210. Finduilas, daughter of Aradreth, the king, knew Gwyndor and welcomed him, for she had loved him before the Nirnaeth. And so greatly did Gwyndor love her beauty that he named her Vailivrin, which is the gleam of the sun on the pools of Ivrin. End of note. But they knew not that Nargothrond had fallen, and this was Turin, son of Hurin, the Black Sword. Thus, only for a moment, and never again, did the paths of those kinsmen, Turin and Tuor, draw together. When the Black Sword had passed, Tuor and Varanwë held on their way for a while, though day had come. for the memory of his grief was heavy upon them, and they could not endure to remain beside the defilement of Ivrin. But before long they sought a hiding place, for all the land was filled now with a foreboding of evil. They slept little and uneasily, and as the day wore it grew dark, and a great snow fell, and with the night came a grinding frost. Thereafter, the snow and ice relented not at all, and for 5 months the fell winter, long remembered, held the north in bonds. Now, Tuor and Varanwë were tormented by the cold, and feared to be revealed by the snow to hunting enemies, or to fall into hidden dangers treacherously cloaked. 9 days they held on, ever slower and more painfully, and Varanwë turned somewhat north, until they crossed the 3 well streams of Teiglin. And then he bore eastward again, leaving the mountains, and went warily until they passed Glithui, and came to the stream of Maldwin, and it was frozen black. Note 16. The river Glithui is not mentioned in the Silmarillion, and is not named on the map, though it is shown. A tributary of the Teiglin joining that river some way north of the inflowing of the Maldwin. End of note. Then Tuor said to Varanwë, "Fell is this frost, and death draws near to me, if not to you." For they were now in evil case. It was long since they had found any food in the wild, and the waybread was dwindling, and they were cold and weary. "Ill is it to be trapped between the doom of the Valar and the malice of the enemy," said Varanwë. "Have I escaped the mouths of the sea but to lie under the snow?" But Tuor said, "How far is now to go? For at last, Varanwë, you must forego your secrecy with me. Do you lead me straight, and whither? For if I must spend my last strength, I would know to what that may avail." "I have led you as straight as I safely might," answered Varanwë. "Know then now that Turgon dwells still in the north of the land of the Eldar, though that is believed by few. Already we draw nigh to him, yet there are many leagues still to go, even as a bird might fly. And for us, Sirion is yet to cross, and great evil, maybe, lies between. For we must come soon to the highway that ran of old down from the Minas of King Finrod to Nargothrond." Note 17. This road is referred to in the Silmarillion, page 205. The ancient road that led through the long defile of Sirion, past the isle where Minas Tirith of Finrod had stood, and so through the land between Maldwin and Sirion, and on through the eaves of Brethil to the crossings of Teiglin. End of note. There the servants of the enemy will walk and watch. "I counted myself the hardiest of men," said Tuor, "and I have endured many winters' woe in the mountains. But I had a cave at my back and fire then, and I doubt now my strength to go much further thus hungry through the fell weather. But let us go on, as far as we may, before hope fails." "No other choice have we," said Varanwë, "unless it be to lay us down here and seek the snow sleep." Therefore all through that bitter day they toiled on, deeming the peril of foes less than the winter. But ever as they went they found less snow, for they were now going southward again, down into the vale of Sirion, and the mountains of Dorloman were left far behind. In the deepening dusk, they came to the highway, at the bottom of a tall, wooded bank. Suddenly they were aware of voices, and looking out warily from the trees, they saw a red light below. A company of orcs was encamped in the midst of the road, huddled about a large wood fire. "Girth on Glamhoth," Tuor muttered. Note 18. Death to the Glamhoth. This name, though it does not occur in the Silmarillion or in the Lord of the Rings, was a general term in the Sindarin language for orcs. The meaning is Din Horde, host of tumult. Compare Gandalf's sword, Glamdring, and Tol Ingarhoth, the Isle of the Host of Werewolves. End of note. "Now the sword shall come from under the cloak. I will risk death for mastery of that fire, and even the meat of orcs would be a prize." "Nay," said Varanwë, "on this quest only the cloak will serve. You must forgo the fire, or else forgo Turgon. This band is not alone in the wild. Cannot your mortal sight see the far flame of other posts to the north and to the south? A tumult will bring a host upon us.
Hearken to me, Tuor. It is against the law of the Hidden Kingdom that any should approach the gates with foes at their heels, and that law I will not break, neither for Ulmo's bidding nor for death. Rouse the orcs, and I leave you.
Then let them be, said Tuor, but may I live yet to see the day when I need not sneak aside from a handful of orcs like a cowed dog.
Come then, said Varanwë. Debate no more, or they will scent us. Follow me.
He crept then away through the trees, southward, down the wind, until they were midway between that orc fire and the next upon the road. There he stood still a long while, listening.
I hear none moving on the road, he said, but we know not what may be lurking in the shadows.
He peered forward into the gloom and shuddered.
The air is evil, he muttered. Alas, yonder lies the land of our quest and hope of life, but death walks between.
Death is all about us, said Tuor, but I have strength left only for the shortest road. Here I must cross, or perish. I will trust to the mantle of Ulmo, and you also it shall cover. Now I will lead.
So saying, he stole to the border of the road. Then clasping Varanwë close, he cast about them both the folds of the gray cloak of the Lord of Waters, and stepped forth. All was still. The cold wind sighed as it swept down the ancient road. Then suddenly, it too fell silent. In the pause, Tuor felt a change in the air, as if the breath from the land of Morgoth had failed a while, and faint as a memory of the sea came a breeze from the west. As a gray mist on the wind, they passed over the stony street and entered a thicket on its eastern brink. All at once, from near at hand, there came a wild cry, and many others along the borders of the road answered it. A harsh horn blared, and there was the sound of running feet. But Tuor held on. He had learned enough of the tongue of the orcs in his captivity to know the meaning of those cries. The watchers had scented them and heard them, but they were not seen. The hunt was out. Desperately he stumbled and crept forward with Varanwë at his side, up a long slope, deep in whin and whortleberry, among knots of rowan and low birch. At the top of the ridge they halted, listening to the shouts behind and the crashing of the orcs in the undergrowth below. Beside them was a boulder that reared its head out of a tangle of heath and brambles, and beneath it was such a lair as a hunted beast might seek and hope there to escape pursuit, or at the least, with its back to stone, to sell its life dearly. Down into the dark shadow, Tuor drew Varanwë, and side by side under the gray cloak they lay and panted like tired foxes. No word they spoke. All their heed was in their ears. The cries of the hunters grew fainter, for the orcs thrust never deep into the wild lands at either hand, but swept rather down and up the road. They recked little of stray fugitives, but spies they feared, and the scouts of armed foes. For Morgoth had set a guard on the highway, not to ensnare Tuor and Varanwë, of whom as yet he knew nothing, nor any coming from the west, but to watch for the Black Sword, lest he should escape and pursue the captives of Nargothrond, bringing help, it might be, out of Doriath. The night passed, and the brooding silence lay again upon the empty lands. Weary and spent, Tuor slept beneath Ulmo's cloak, but Varanwë crept forth and stood like a stone, silent, unmoving, piercing the shadows with his elvish eyes. At the break of day he woke Tuor, and he, creeping out, saw that the weather had indeed for a time relented, and the black clouds were rolled aside. There was a red dawn, and he could see far before him the tops of strange mountains glinting against the eastern fire. Then Varanwë said in a low voice,
Alai, Eriden Echoriath, Eriden Barnin.
Note 19. Echoriath, the encircling mountains about the plain of Gondolin. Ered Embarnin, the mountains of my home. End of note. For he knew that he looked on the encircling mountains and the walls of the realm of Turgon. Below them, eastward, in a deep and shadowy vale, lay Sirion the Fair, renowned in song, and beyond, wrapped in mist, a gray land climbed from the river to the broken hills at the mountain's feet.
Yonder lies Dimbar, said Varanwë. Would we were there.
for there our foes seldom dare to walk. Or so it was, while the power of Ulmo was strong in Sirion. But all may now be changed, save the peril of the river. It is already deep and swift, and even for the Eldar dangerous to cross. Note 20. In the Silmarillion, pages 200 and 201, Beleg of Dorioth said to Turin, at a time some years before that of the present narrative, that orcs had made a road through the pass of Anach, and Dimbar, which used to be at peace, is falling under the Black Hand. End of note.
But I have led you well, for there gleams the ford of Brithioch, yet a little southward, where the east road that of old ran all the way from Taras in the west, made the passage of the river. None now dare to use it save in desperate need, neither elf nor man nor orc, since that road leads to Dungortheb, and the land of dread between the Gargaroth and the girdle of Melion. And long since has it faded into the wild, or dwindled to a track among weeds and trailing thorns.
Note 21. By this road Maeglin and Arathel fled to Gondolin, pursued by Eol, the Silmarillion, chapter 16. And afterwards, Celegorm and Curufin took it when they were expelled from Nargothrond. Ibid, page 176. Only in the present text is there any mention of its westward extension to Turgon's ancient home at Vinyamar, under Mount Taras, and its course is not marked on the map from its junction with the old south road to Nargothrond at the northwestern edge of Brethil. End of note. Then Tuar looked as Varanwë pointed, and far away he caught the glimmer as of open waters under the brief light of dawn. But beyond loomed a darkness, where the great forest of Brethil climbed away southward into a distant highland. Now warily they made their way down the valleyside, until at last they came to the ancient road descending from the Waymeet on the borders of Brethil, where it crossed the highway from Nargothrond. Then Tuar saw that they were come close to Sirion. The banks of its deep channel fell away in that place, and its waters, choked by a great waste of stones, were spread out into broad shallows, full of the murmur of fretting streams. Note 22. The name, Brithioch, contains the element Brith, gravel, as also in the river Brithon, and the haven of Brithombar. End of note. Then, after a little, the river gathered together again, and delving a new bed, flowed away towards the forest, and far off, vanished into a deep mist that his eye could not pierce. For there lay, though he knew it not, the north march of Dorioth, within the shadow of the girdle of Melion. At once Tuar would hasten to the ford, but Varanwë restrained him, saying, "Over the Brithioch we may not go in open day, nor while any doubt of pursuit remains." "Then shall we sit here and rot?" said Tuar. "For such doubt will remain while the realm of Morgoth endures. Come, under the shadow of the cloak of Ulmo we must go forward." Still Varanwë hesitated and looked back westward, but the track behind was deserted, and all about was quiet, save for the rush of the waters. He looked up, and the sky was gray and empty, for not even a bird was moving. Then suddenly his face brightened with joy, and he cried aloud, "It is well! The Brithioch is guarded still by the enemies of the enemy. The orcs will not follow us here, and under the cloak we may pass now without more doubt." "What new thing have you seen?" said Tuar. "Short is the sight of mortal men," said Varanwë. "I see the eagles of the Chrysaigrim, and they are coming hither. Watch a while." Then Tuar stood at gaze, and soon high in the air he saw three shapes beating on strong wings down from the distant mountain peaks, now wreathed again in cloud. Slowly they descended in great circles, and then stooped suddenly upon the wayfarers. But before Varanwë could call to them, they turned with a wide sweep and rush, and flew northward along the line of the river. "Now let us go," said Varanwë. "If there be any orc nearby, he will lie cowering nose to ground until the eagles have gone far away." Swiftly down a long slope they hastened, and passed over the Brithioch, walking often dryfoot upon shelves of shingle, or wading in the shoals no more than knee-deep. The water was clear and very cold, and there was ice upon the shallow pools, where the wandering streams had lost their way among the stones. But never, not even in the fell winter of the fall of Nargothrond, could the deadly breath of the north freeze the main flood of Sirion. Note 23. In a parallel version of the text at this point, almost certainly rejected in favor of the one printed, the travelers did not cross the Sirion by the ford of Brithiach, but reached the river several leagues to the north of it. They trod a toilsome path to the brink of the river, and there Varanwë cried,
"See a wonder! Both good and ill does it forebode. Sirion is frozen, though no tale tells of the like since the coming of the Eldar out of the east. Thus we may pass and save many weary miles, too long for our strength. Yet thus also others may have passed, or may follow."
They crossed the river on the ice unhindered, and thus did the counsels of Ulmo turn the malice of the enemy to avail, for the way was shortened, and at the end of their hope and strength, Tuar and Varanwë came at last to the dry river at its issuing from the skirts of the mountains. End of note. On the far side of the ford they came to a gully, as it were the bed of an old stream, in which no water now flowed. Yet once, it seemed, a torrent had cloven its deep channel, coming down from the north out of the mountains of the Echoriath, and bearing thence all the stones of the Brithiach down into Sirion.
"At last, beyond hope, we find it," cried Varanwë. "See, here is the mouth of the dry river, and that is the road we must take."
Note 24. Compare the Silmarillion, page 125. But there was a deep way under the mountains, delved in the darkness of the world, by waters that flowed out to join the streams of Sirion. And this way Turgon found, and so came to the green plain amid the mountains, and saw the island hill that stood there of hard, smooth stone. For the vale had been a great lake in ancient days. End of note. Then they passed into the gully, and as it turned north and the slopes of the land went steeply up, so its sides rose upon either hand, and Tuor stumbled in the dim light among the stones with which its rough bed was strewn. "If this is a road," he said, "it is an evil one for the weary."
"Yet it is the road to Turgon," said Varanwë.
"Then the more do I marvel," said Tuor, "that its entrance lies open and unguarded. I had looked to find a great gate and strength of guard."
"That you shall yet see," said Varanwë. "This is but the approach. A road, I named it. Yet upon it none have passed for more than 300 years, save messengers few and secret, and all the craft of the Noldor has been expended to conceal it, since the hidden people entered in. Does it lie open? Would you have known it, if you had not had one of the hidden kingdom for a guide? Or would you have guessed it to be the work of the weathers and the waters of the wilderness? And are there not the eagles, as you have seen? They are the folk of Thorondor, who dwelt once even on Thangorodrim, ere Morgoth grew so mighty, and dwell now in the mountains of Turgon since the fall of Fingolfin."
Note 25. It is not said in the Silmarillion that the great eagles ever dwelt on Thangorodrim. In chapter 13, page 110, Manwë sent forth the race of eagles, commanding them to dwell in the crags of the north and to keep watch upon Morgoth. While in chapter 18, page 154, Thorondor came hasting from his eyrie among the peaks of the Chrysaigrim for the rescue of Fingolfin's body before the gates of Angband. Compare, also, The Return of the King, 6-4. Old Thorondor, who built his eyries in the inaccessible peaks of the encircling mountains when Middle-earth was young. In all probability, the conception of Thorondor's dwelling at first upon Thangorodrim, which is found also in an early Silmarillion text, was later abandoned. End of note. They alone, save the Noldor, know the hidden kingdom, and guard the skies above it, though as yet no servant of the enemy has dared to fly into the high airs, and they bring much news to the king of all that moves in the lands without. Had we been orcs, doubt not that we should have been seized and cast from a great height upon the pitiless rocks.
"I doubt it not," said Tuar, "but it comes into my mind to wonder also whether news will not now come to Turgon of our approach swifter than we. And if that be good or ill, you alone can say."
"Neither good nor ill," said Varanwë, "for we cannot pass the guarded gate unmarked, be we looked for or no. And if we come there, the guards will need no report that we are not orcs. But to pass, we shall need a greater plea than that. For you do not guess, Tuor, the peril that we then shall face. Blame me not as one unwarned for what may then betide. May the power of the Lord of Waters be shown indeed. For in that hope alone have I been willing to guide you, and if it fails, then more surely shall we die than by all the perils of wild and winter. But Tuor said, Forebode no more. Death in the wild is certain, and death at the gate is yet in doubt to me, for all your words. Lead me still on. Many miles they toiled on in the stones of the dry river, until they could go no further, and the evening brought darkness into the deep cleft. They climbed out then onto the east bank, and they had now come to the tumbled hills that lay at the feet of the mountains. And looking up, Tuor saw that they towered up in a fashion other than that of any mountains that he had seen, for their sides were like sheer walls, piled each one above and behind the lower, as were they great towers of many-storied precipices. But the day had waned, and all the lands were gray and misty, and the vale of Sirion was shrouded in shadow. Then Varanwë led him to a shallow cave in a hillside that looked out over the lonely slopes of Dimbar, and they crept within, and there they lay hid, and they ate their last crumbs of food, and were cold and weary, but slept not. Thus did Tuor and Varanwë come in the dusk of the 18th day of Hisime, the 37th of their journey, to the towers of the Ikhoriath and the threshold of Turgon, and by the power of Ulmo escaped both the doom and the malice. When the first glimmer of day filtered gray amid the mists of Dimbar, they crept back into the dry river, and soon after its course turned eastward, winding up to the very walls of the mountains, and straight before them there loomed a great precipice, rising sheer and sudden from a steep slope, upon which grew a tangled thicket of thorn trees. Into this thicket the stony channel entered, and there it was still dark as night. And they halted, for the thorns grew far down the sides of the gully, and their lacing branches were a dense roof above it, so low that often Tuor and Varanwë must crawl under like beasts stealing back to their lair. But at last, as with great labor, they came to the very foot of the cliff, they found an opening, as it were the mouth of a tunnel worn in the hard rock by waters flowing from the heart of the mountains. They entered, and within there was no light, but Varanwë went steadily forward, while Tuor followed with his hand upon his shoulder, bending a little, for the roof was low. Thus for a time they went on blindly, step by step, until presently they felt the ground beneath their feet had become level and free from loose stones. Then they halted and breathed deeply as they stood, listening. The air seemed fresh and wholesome, and they were aware of a great space around and above them, but all was silent, and not even the drip of water could be heard. It seemed to Tuor that Varanwë was troubled and in doubt, and he whispered, Where then is the guarded gate, or have we indeed now passed it? Nay, said Varanwë, yet I wonder, for it is strange that any incomer should creep thus far unchallenged. I fear some stroke in the dark. But their whispers aroused the sleeping echoes, and they were enlarged and multiplied, and ran in the roof and the unseen walls, hissing and murmuring as the sound of many stealthy voices. And even as the echoes died in the stone, Tuor heard out of the heart of the darkness a voice speak in the elven tongues, first in the high speech of the Noldor, which he knew not, and then in the tongue of Beleriand, though in a manner somewhat strange to his ears, as of a people long sundered from their kin. Note 26. In the Silmarillion, nothing is said specifically concerning the speech of the elves of Gondolin, but this passage suggests that for some of them the high speech, Quenya, was in ordinary use. It is stated in a late linguistic essay that Quenya was in daily use in Turgon's house, and was the childhood speech of Earendil, but that for most of the people of Gondolin it had become a language of books, and as the other Noldor they used Sindarin in daily speech. Compare the Silmarillion, page 129. After the Edict of Thingol, the exiles took the Sindarin tongue in all their daily uses, and the high speech of the West was spoken only by the lords of the Noldor among themselves. Yet that speech lived ever as a language of lore, wherever any of that people dwelt. End of note. Stand, it said. Stir not, or you will die, be you foes or friends. We are friends, said Varanwë. Then do as we bid, said the voice. The echo of their voices rolled into silence. Varanwë and Tuor stood still, and it seemed to Tuor that many slow minutes passed, and a fear was in his heart such as no other peril of his road had brought. Then there came the beat of feet, growing to a tramping loud as the march of trolls in that hollow place. Suddenly an elven lantern was unhooded, and its bright ray was turned upon Varanwë before him. But nothing else could Tuor see save a dazzling star in the darkness. And he knew that while that beam was upon him, he could not move, neither to flee nor to run forward. For a moment they were held thus in the eye of the light, and then the voice spoke again, saying, "Show your faces." And Varanwë cast back his hood, and his face shone in the ray, hard and clear, as if graven in stone. And Tuor marveled to see its beauty. Then he spoke proudly, saying, "Know you not whom you see? I am Varanwë, son of Varanwë, of the House of Fingolfin. Or am I forgotten in my own land after a few years? Far beyond the thought of Middle-earth I have wandered, yet I remember your voice, Elemakil." "Then Varanwë will remember also the laws of his land," said the voice. "Since by command he went forth, he has the right to return, but not to lead hither any stranger. By that deed his right is void, and he must be led as a prisoner to the king's judgment. As for the stranger, he shall be slain or held captive at the judgment of the guard. Lead him hither that I may judge." Then Varanwë led Tuor towards the light, and as they drew near, many Noldor, mail-clad and armed, stepped forward out of the darkness and surrounded them with drawn swords. And Elemakil, captain of the guard, who bore the bright lamp, looked long and closely at them. "This is strange in you, Varanwë," he said. "We were long friends. Why then would you set me thus cruelly between the law and my friendship? If you had led hither unbidden one of the other houses of the Noldor, that were enough. But you have brought to knowledge of the way a mortal man, for by his eyes I perceive his kin. Yet free can he never again go, knowing the secret. And as one of alien kin that has dared to enter, I should slay him, even though he be your friend and dear to you. In the wide lands without, Elemakil, many strange things may befall one, and tasks unlooked for be laid on one," Varanwë answered. "Other shall the wanderer return than as he set forth. What I have done under command, greater than the law of the guard. The king alone should judge me, and him that comes with me." Then Tuor spoke, and feared no longer. "I come with Varanwë, son of Varanwë, because he was appointed to be my guide by the Lord of Waters. To this end was he delivered from the wrath of the sea and the doom of the Valar. For I bear from Ulmo an errand to the son of Fingolfin, and to him will I speak it." Thereat Elemakil looked in wonder upon Tuor. "Who then are you?" he said. "And whence come you?" "I am Tuor, son of Huar of the House of Hador, and the kindred of Hurin. And these names, I am told, are not unknown in the Hidden Kingdom. From Nevrost I have come, through many perils, to seek it." "From Nevrost?" said Elemakil. "It is said that none dwell there, since our people departed." "It is said, truly," answered Tuor. "Empty and cold stand the courts of Vinyamar. Yet thence I come. Bring me now to him that built those halls of old." "In matters so great, judgment is not mine," said Elemakil. "Therefore I will lead you to the light, where more may be revealed, and I will deliver you to the warden of the great gate." Then he spoke in command, and Tuor and Varanwë were set between tall guards, two before and three behind them, and their captain led them from the cavern of the outer guard, and they passed, as it seemed, into a straight passage, and there walked long upon a level floor, until a pale light gleamed ahead. Thus they came at length to a wide arch, with tall pillars upon either hand, hewn in the rock. And between hung a great portcullis of crossed wooden bars, marvelously carved and studded with nails of iron. Elemakil touched it, and it rose silently, and they passed through. And Tuor saw that they stood at the end of a ravine, the like of which he had never before beheld or imagined in his thought, long though he had walked in the wild mountains of the north. For beside the Orfach Echor, Kirith Niniach was but a groove in the rock. Here the hands of the Valar themselves, in ancient wars of the world's beginning, had wrested the great mountains asunder, and the sides of the rift were sheer, as if axe-cloven, and they towered up to heights unguessable. There, far aloft, ran a ribbon of sky, and against its deep blue stood black peaks and jagged pinnacles, remote but hard, cruel as spears. Too high were those mighty walls for the winter sun to overlook, and though it was now full morning, faint stars glimmered above the mountaintops, and down below all was dim, but for the pale light of lamps set beside the climbing road. For the floor of the ravine sloped steeply up, eastward, and upon the left hand, Tuor saw beside the stream bed a wide way, laid and paved with stone, winding upward till it vanished into shadow.
"You have passed the first gate, the gate of wood," said Elemakil. "There lies the way. We must hasten."
How far that deep road ran, Tuor could not guess, and as he stared onward, a great weariness came upon him like a cloud. A chill wind hissed over the faces of the stones, and he drew his cloak close about him.
"Cold blows the wind from the Hidden Kingdom," he said.
"Yea, indeed," said Varanwë. "To a stranger it might seem that pride has made the servants of Turgon pitiless. Long and hard seem the leagues of the Seven Gates to the hungry and wayworn.
If our law were less stern, long ago guile and hatred would have entered and destroyed us. That you know well," said Elemakil. "But we are not pitiless. Here there is no food, and the stranger may not go back through a gate that he has passed. Endure then a little, and at the second gate you shall be eased."
"It is well," said Tuor, and he went forward as he was bidden. After a little he turned and saw that Elemakil alone followed with Varanwë.
"There is no need more of guards," said Elemakil,
reading his thought. "From the Orfoch there is no escape for elf or man, and no returning." Thus they went on up the steep way, sometimes by long stairs, sometimes by winding slopes, under the daunting shadow of the cliff, until some half league from the wooden gate, Tuor saw that the way was barred by a great wall built across the ravine from side to side, with stout towers of stone at either hand. In the wall was a great archway above the road, but it seemed that masons had blocked it with a single mighty stone. As they drew near, its dark and polished face gleamed in the light of a white lamp that hung above the midst of the arch.
"Here stands the second gate, the gate of stone," said Elemakil, and going up to it, he thrust lightly upon it.
It turned upon an unseen pivot until its edge was towards them, and the way was open upon either side, and they passed through into a court where stood many armed guards clad in gray. No word was spoken, but Elemakil led his charges to a chamber beneath the northern tower, and there food and wine was brought to them, and they were permitted to rest a while.
"Scant may the fare seem," said Elemakil to Tuor, "but if your claim be proved, hereafter it shall richly be amended."
"It is enough," said Tuor, faint with a heart that needed better healing. And indeed, such refreshment did he find in the drink and food of the Noldor that soon he was eager to go on. After a little space they came to a wall yet higher and stronger than before, and in it was set the third gate, the gate of bronze, a great twofold door hung with shields and plates of bronze, wherein were wrought many figures and strange signs. Upon the wall above its lintel were three square towers, roofed and clad with copper that by some device of smithcraft were ever bright and gleamed as fire in the rays of the red lamps ranged like torches along the wall. Again silently they passed the gate and saw in the court beyond a yet greater company of guards in mail that glowed like dull fire, and the blades of their axes were red. Of the kindred of the Sindar of Nevrost, for the most part, were those that held this gate. Now they came to the most toilsome road, for in the midst of the Orfoch the slope was at the steepest, and as they climbed, Tuor saw the mightiest of the walls looming dark above him. Thus at last they drew near the fourth gate, the gate of writhen iron. High and black was the wall, and lit with no lamps. Four towers of iron stood upon it, and between the two inner towers was set an image of a great eagle wrought in iron. Even the likeness of King Thorondor himself, as he would alight upon a mountain from the high airs. But as Tuor stood before the gate, it seemed to his wonder that he was looking through boughs and stems of imperishable trees into a pale glade of the moon. For a light came through the traceries of the gate, which were wrought and hammered into the shapes of trees with writhing roots and woven branches laden with leaves and flowers. And as he passed through, he saw how this could be. For the wall was of great thickness, and there was not one grille, but three in line, so set that to one who approached in the middle of the way, each formed part of the device. but the light beyond was the light of day. For they had climbed now to a great height above the lowlands where they began, and beyond the iron gate the road ran almost level. Moreover, they had passed the crown and heart of the Echorioth, and the mountain towers now fell swiftly down towards the inner hills, and the ravine opened wider, and its sides became less sheer. Its long shoulders were mantled with white snow, and the light of the sky, snow-mirrored, came white as moonlight through a glimmering mist that filled the air. Now they passed through the lines of the iron guards that stood behind the gate. Black were their mantles, and their mail and long shields, and their faces were masked with visors, bearing each an eagle's beak. Then Elemakil went before them, and they followed him into the pale light, and Tuor saw beside the way a sward of grass, where like stars bloomed the white flowers of Uilos, the ever-mind that knows no season and withers not. And thus in wonder and lightening of heart he was brought to the gate of silver. Note 27. These were the flowers that bloomed abundantly on the burial mounds of the kings of Rohan, below Edoras, and which Gandalf named in the language of the Rohirrim, as translated into Old English, Simbelmine, that is, Evermind, for they blossom in all the seasons of the year, and grow where dead men rest. The two towers, 3-6. The elvish name Uilos is only given in this passage, but the word is found also in Amun Uilos, as the Quenya name Oiolase, ever snow-white. The mountain of Manwë was rendered into Sindarin. In Cirion and Eorl, the flower is given another elvish name, Alfirin, page 303. End of note. The wall of the fifth gate was built of white marble and was low and broad, and its parapet was a trellis of silver between five great globes of marble, and there stood many archers robed in white. The gate was in shape as three parts of a circle, and wrought of silver and pearl of Nevrost in likenesses of the moon. But above the gate, upon the midmost globe, stood an image of the white tree, Telperion, wrought of silver and malachite, with flowers made of great pearls of Balar. Note 28. In the Silmarillion, page 92, it is said that Thingol rewarded the dwarves of Belagost with many pearls. These Círdan gave to him, for they were got in great number in the shallow waters about the Isle of Balar. End of note. And beyond the gate, in a wide court, paved with marble green and white, stood archers in silver mail and white-crested helms, 100 upon either hand. Then Elemakil led Tuor and Varanwë through their silent ranks, and they entered upon a long white road that ran straight towards the sixth gate. And as they went, the grass sward became whiter, and among the white stars of Uilos there opened many small flowers like eyes of gold. So they came to the Golden Gate, the last of the ancient gates of Turgon that were wrought before the Nirnaeth. And it was much like the gate of silver, save that the wall was built of yellow marble, and the globes and parapet were of red gold. And there were six globes, and in the midst, upon a golden pyramid, was set an image of Laurelin, the tree of the sun, with flowers wrought of topaz in long clusters upon chains of gold. And the gate itself was adorned with discs of gold, many rayed in likenesses of the sun, set amid devices of garnet and topaz and yellow diamonds. In the court beyond were arrayed 300 archers with long bows, and their mail was gilded, and tall golden plumes rose from their helmets, and their great round shields were red as flame. Now sunlight fell upon the further road, for the walls of the hills were low on either side, and green, but for the snows upon their tops. And Elemakil hastened forward, for the way was short to the seventh gate, named the Great, the gate of steel that Maeglin wrought after the return from the Nirnaeth, across the wide entrance to the Orfoch Echor. No wall stood there, but on either hand were two round towers of great height, many-windowed, tapering in seven stories to a turret of bright steel, and between the towers there stood a mighty fence of steel that rusted not, but glittered cold and white. Seven great pillars of steel there were, tall with the height and girth of strong young trees, but ending in a bitter spike that rose to the sharpness of a needle, and between the pillars were 7 crossbars of steel, and in each space 7 times 7 rods of steel upright, with heads like the broad blades of spears. But in the center, above the midmost pillar and the greatest, was raised a mighty image of the King Helm of Turgon, the crown of the Hidden Kingdom, set about with diamonds. No gate or door could Tuor see in this mighty hedge of steel, but as he drew near through the spaces between its bars there came, as it seemed to him, a dazzling light, and he shaded his eyes and stood still in dread and wonder. But Alemakil went forward, and no gate opened to his touch. But he struck upon a bar, and the fence rang like a harp of many strings, giving forth clear notes in harmony that ran from tower to tower. Straightway there issued riders from the towers, but before those of the North Tower came one upon a white horse, and he dismounted and strode towards them. And high and noble as was Alemakil, greater and more lordly was Ecthelion, Lord of the Fountains, at that time Warden of the Great Gate. Note 29. Ecthelion of the Fountain is mentioned in the Silmarillion as one of Turgon's captains who guarded the flanks of the host of Gondolin in their retreat down Sirion from the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad, and as the slayer of Gothmog, Lord of Balrogs, by whom he himself was slain in the assault on the city. End of note. All in silver was he clad, and upon his shining helm there was set a spike of steel pointed with a diamond, and as his esquire took his shield, it shimmered as if it were bedewed with drops of rain that were indeed 1,000 studs of crystal. Alemakil saluted him and said, "Here have I brought Varanwë Aranwëon, returning from Balar, and here is the stranger that he has led hither, who demands to see the king." Then Ecthelion turned to Tuor, but he drew his cloak about him and stood silent, facing him. And it seemed to Varanwë that a mist mantled Tuor, and his stature was increased, so that the peak of his high hood overtopped the helm of the elf lord, as it were the crest of a gray sea-wave riding to the land. But Ecthelion bent his bright glance upon Tuor, and after a silence he spoke gravely, saying, "You have come to the last gate. Know then that no stranger who passes it shall ever go out again, save by the door of death." Note 30. From this point, the carefully written, though much amended, manuscript ceases, and the remainder of the narrative is hastily scribbled on a scrap of paper. End of note. "Speak not ill-boding. If the messenger of the Lord of Waters go by that door, then all those who dwell here will follow him. Lord of the Fountains, hinder not the messenger of the Lord of Waters." Then Varanwë and all those who stood near looked again in wonder at Tuor, marveling at his words and voice. And to Varanwë it seemed as if he heard a great voice, but as of one who called from afar off. But to Tuor it seemed that he listened to himself speaking, as if another spoke with his mouth. For a while Ecthelion stood silent, looking at Tuor, and slowly awe filled his face, as if in the gray shadow of Tuor's cloak he saw visions from far away. Then he bowed and went to the fence and laid hands upon it, and gates opened inward on either side of the pillar of the crown. Then Tuor passed through, and coming to a high sward that looked out over the valley beyond, he beheld a vision of Gondolin amid the white snow. And so entranced was he that for long he could look at nothing else, for he saw before him at last the vision of his desire out of dreams of longing. Thus he stood and spoke no word. Silent upon either hand stood a host of the army of Gondolin. All of the 7 kinds of the 7 gates were there represented, but their captains and chieftains were upon horses, white and gray. Then, even as they gazed on Tuor in wonder, his cloak fell down, and he stood there before them in the mighty livery of Nevrost. And many were there who had seen Turgon himself set these things upon the wall behind the high seat of Vinyamar. Then Ecthelion said at last, "Now no further proof is needed. And even the name he claims as son of Huar matters less than this clear truth, that he comes from Ulmo himself." Note 31. Here the narrative finally comes to an end, and there remain only some hasty jottings indicating the course of the story. Tuor asked the name of the city, and was told its 7 names. It is notable, and no doubt intentional, that the name Gondolin is never once used in the narrative until the very end, page 51. Always it is called the Hidden Kingdom, or the Hidden City. Ecthelion gave orders for the sounding of the signal, and trumpets were blown on the towers of the Great Gate, echoing in the hills. After a hush, they heard far off answering trumpets blown upon the city walls. Horses were brought, a gray horse for Tuor, and they rode to Gondolin. A description of Gondolin was to follow, of the stairs up to its high platform and its great gate, of the mounds, this word is uncertain, of Malorns, birches, and evergreen trees, of the place of the fountain, the king's tower on a pillared arcade, the king's house, and the banner of Fingolfin. Now Turgon himself would appear, tallest of all the children of the world, save Thingol, with a white and gold sword, and a Ruabon, ivory sheath, and welcome, Tuor. Maeglin would be seen standing on the right of the throne, and Idril, the king's daughter, seated on the left, and Tuor would speak the message of Ulmo, either in the hearing of all, or in the council chamber. Other disjointed notes indicate that there was to be a description of Gondolin as seen by Tuor from far off, that Ulmo's cloak would vanish when Tuor spoke the message of Turgon, that it would be explained why there was no queen of Gondolin, and that it was to be emphasized either when Tuor first set eyes upon Idril or at some earlier point that he had known or even seen few women in his life. Most of the women and all the children of Anil's company in Mithrim were sent away south, and as a thrall, Tuor had seen only the proud and barbaric women of the Easterlings, who treated him as a beast, or the unhappy slaves forced to labor from childhood, for whom he had only pity. It may be noted that later mentions of Malorns in Numenor, Lindon, and Lothlorien do not suggest, though they do not deny, that those trees flourished in Gondolin in the Elder Days. See pages 167 and 168. And that the wife of Turgon, Elenwë, was lost long before in the crossing of the Helcaraxe by the host of Fingolfin. The Silmarillion, page 90. End of note. 2. Narn y Hin Hurin, The Tale of the Children of Hurin. The Childhood of Turin. Hador Goldenhead was a lord of the Edain and well-beloved by the Eldar. He dwelt while his days lasted under the lordship of Fingolfin, who gave to him wide lands in that region of Hithlum, which was called Dorloman. His daughter, Glorathel, wedded Haldir, son of Halmir, lord of the men of Brethil, and at the same feast his son Galdor the Tall wedded Harith, the daughter of Halmir. Galdor and Harith had two sons, Hurin and Huar. Hurin was by 3 years the elder, but he was shorter in stature than other men of his kin. In this he took after his mother's people, but in all else he was like Hador, his grandfather, fair of face and golden-haired, strong in body and fiery of mood. But the fire in him burned steadily, and he had great endurance of will. Of all men of the north, he knew most of the counsels of the Noldor. Huar, his brother, was tall, the tallest of all the Edain, save his own son, Tuor, only, and a swift runner. But if the race were long and hard, Hurin would be the first home, for he ran as strongly at the end of the course as at the beginning. There was great love between the brothers, and they were seldom apart in their youth. Hurin wedded Morwen, the daughter of Baragund, son of Bregolas, of the house of Beor. And she was thus of close kin to Beren Onehand. Morwen was dark-haired and tall, and for the light of her glance and the beauty of her face, men called her Eledwin, the Elven Fair, but she was somewhat stern of mood and proud. The sorrows of the House of Beor saddened her heart, for she came as an exile to Dorloman from Drothonion after the ruin of the Bragolach. Turin was the name of the eldest child of Hurin and Morwen, and he was born in that year in which Beren came to Dorioth, and found Luthien Tenuviel, Thingol's daughter. Morwen bore a daughter also to Hurin, and she was named Urwen. But she was called Lalaith, which is laughter, by all that knew her in her short life. Huar wedded Rion, the cousin of Morwen. She was the daughter of Belagund, son of Bregolas. By hard fate was she born into such days, for she was gentle of heart, and loved neither hunting nor war. Her love was given to trees and to the flowers of the wild, and she was a singer and a maker of songs. 2 months only had she been wedded to Huar, when he went with his brother to the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad, and she never saw him again. Note 1. At this point, in the text of the Narn, there is a passage describing the sojourn of Húrin and Húar in Gondolin. This is very closely based on the story told in one of the constituent texts of the Silmarillion, so closely as to be no more than a variant, and I have not given it again here. The story can be read in the Silmarillion, pages 158 and 159. End of note. In the years after the Dagor Bragolach and the fall of Fingolfin, the shadow of the fear of Morgoth lengthened. But in the 469th year after the return of the Noldor to Middle-earth, there was a stirring of hope among elves and men. For the rumor ran among them of the deeds of Beren and Lúthien, and the putting to shame of Morgoth, even upon his throne in Angband. And some said that Beren and Lúthien yet lived, or had returned from the dead. In that year also the great councils of Maedhros were almost complete, and with the reviving strength of the Eldar and the Edain, the advance of Morgoth was stayed, and the orcs were driven back from Beleriand. Then some began to speak of victories to come, and of redressing the battle of the Bragolach, when Maedhros should lead forth the united hosts, and drive Morgoth underground, and seal the doors of Angband. But the wiser were uneasy still, fearing that Maedhros revealed his growing strength too soon, and that Morgoth would be given time enough to take counsel against him.